Well, the farmer prayed for a better year, and the crops were good like the Lord did here, but his barn burnt down with winter near. The answer came in white and black, in the farmer's almanac it says, if a man could have half his wishes, he could double his trouble.
The farmer's almanac. Here's a lovely thought. As of today, October 2nd, there are 81 days until winter. The old farmer's almanac says it could be a mild winter in the west, colder in the east. How accurate is the almanac? We'll find out as jet streaming takes off for another week.
Visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man.
A silver-tongued woman here, being the host of Jet Streaming along with my friends, Paul Huttner and Mark Seely. How do you like that? Who picks the music for this thing?
Who found that Johnny Cash gem? That was beautiful.
Sarah Fleener, our producer.
Very nice, Sarah.
Yes, she did a very good job. And welcome, by the way, friends, to yet another edition of Jet Streaming, the podcast devoted to weather and climatology here at Minnesota Public Radio. Good to see you two again, Paul and Mark. How are you?
Good. Glad to be here sharing the airwaves with Johnny Cash. I always liked him.
Good to see you too, Paul.
Thanks.
What weather-related stories, by the way, have you guys seen out there that have kind of piqued your interest? Anything at all? I know you've been busy, Mark Seely, but...
Well, one that caught my attention is it was announced a while back that Lake Superior was at an all-time low, even surpassing the old record in 1926, but... thankfully, it's on the rise now, Kathy. There's been enough rainfall going on around those watersheds that feed Lake Superior that it's up 0.2 feet, which I think is a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Good news for those folks on Lake Superior. What about you, Paul?
Well, we saw with interest the volcano that erupted on the Yemeni Island this week. Gets us to thinking about volcanism. We don't know how big this eruption was just yet, but of course, Mount Pinatubo, Mount Tambora, there are many eruptions over the course of history that have affected our climate by cooling some of the planet. So gives us a reminder we need to watch these kind of things.
Well, another weather story. A few weeks ago, there was the announcement that the old Farmer's Almanac was out for 2008. And the long-term winter predictions, colder in the east, maybe milder in the west. But everyone's going to experience winter. That's a decent prediction.
Yeah.
Joining us with more is Marty Majoros. She's the research editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac. Marty, welcome to Jet Streaming. How are you?
Great. Thank
Good.
You.
Thanks for joining us. I got to begin by asking you this question. How accurate are your predictions in the Old Farmer's Almanac?
Well, we claim 80% accuracy for our predictions, and that's based on taking the averages of, the actual weather, looking at that against our predictions for both temperature and precipitation for each of the 16 regions in the United States. And then we average that as a whole. So we claim 80% accuracy.
Maddie, Paul Huttner here. Thanks for joining us today. That 80% accuracy that you're talking about, you know, given the state of the science on long-range outlooks, it yields a significantly lower accuracy when we talk about seasonal forecasts. Can you give the public any information on, you know, where to find some of the verification criteria, some of the methodology you use to claim that rate?
Well, we track this, you know, in-house. We work with a meteorologist, and we do track our accuracy rate. We claim 80%. We're not always 80%. You know, we sometimes fall short of that. And again, that's really when you look at the whole country as a whole, which means there'll be some areas or some regions for which we falls short of that 80%, but then there will be other areas where we are well above the 80%. It's not as though we're saying we're 80% accurate for all regions for all of the time, because there is a fluctuation in our accuracy rate from region to region.
Say, Marty, I wanted to ask you, in the National Weather Service scheme of things, doing seasonal outlooks is, of course, very difficult, and they deploy numerous models to do so. But one feature of the American landscape that's really come into play a lot more heavily in recent years is climate trends. In other words, for example, in our region, the upper Midwest, Minnesota, where we live, the winter trends for mildness have been absolutely striking. In fact, in historical terms, off the charts, they've been so strong. Do trends come into play in your exploration of methods to look at seasonal outlooks?
Yes, they definitely do, because we use, you know, several factors in coming up with our forecasts. And as I mentioned before, we do use and work with a meteorologist, and we look at, you know, large-scale weather patterns, other kind of weather and climate factors, and we also look at the previous, the 30-year averages available, which I think are the same 30-year averages that, you know, the National Weather Service uses. So we base our predictions on those previous 30-year averages. So they have been changing very rapidly, really, in terms of temperature especially. So that is sort of built in then to our forecast because it's based on those averages.
One area I wanted to follow up on, Marty, that you alluded to earlier is your claim on accuracy is a broad view picture, but for example, when you forecast precipitation in some of the southeastern states or southern states where convective thunderstorms dominate the precipitation form, that is very, very difficult to predict. In fact, most meteorologists I know hate to be annually reviewed based on their predictions for the thunderstorm season. So do you do a little bit of regionalization, for example, where thunderstorm rainfall tends to dominate? Do you approach it a little differently than, say, where these large-scale mid-latitude cyclones tend to dominate?
Yes, we do. We do. We take that into account, and also our forecast for each region is given for a month. You know, we do for each particular region, we give the daily sort of weather forecast, which is kind of a rough brushstroke, you know, cloudy, sunny, rain, snow. And we also give the average temperature for that region and average precipitation for that region. So that has, you know, that varies greatly from region to region. And we do take into account the specific types of weather events that will be most prevalent within that region.
Say, Marty, you mentioned that there are several factors that you look at when you are making your long-range predictions, but as Johnny Cash was singing about earlier here, do you use any old-fashioned bromides?
No. people think, you know, that we are in New Hampshire here and we're watching the woolly bear caterpillars and counting the acorns that have fallen to predict the winter. But while we may do that for fun, that's not our sole means of predicting the weather. It's really much more scientific. You know, we use many of the same resources and technologies that's available to, you know, meteorologists throughout the country. You know, we always like to talk about the woolly bear caterpillars, but they're not really that reliable.
Mm. But you, in the almanac, of course, you do have some really fun things in there.
Oh yes, yes. You know, there are lots of proverbs and sayings. You know, if onion skins are very thin, a mild winter coming in. If they're very thick, it means the winter will be very rough and cold. The more acorns that fall usually indicate a harsher winter. And, you know, the more black on a woolly bear caterpillar indicates a harsher winter. So those are, they're fun things, but they're not how we predict our weather.
Marty, you talk about in the almanac the secret formula. Everybody wants to know what the secret formula for your weather forecasts are seasonally. How has that evolved over the past, 200 years now or so of the almanac?
I'll tell you, the secret formula is housed in a little black box here in Dublin, New Hampshire, and it is so secret, I have never seen it. However, you know, from what we know and from diaries and journals of the first publisher of the Old Farmer's Almanac, Robert B. Thomas, you know, he believed that solar activity was an important factor in trying to predict the weather. And today, that is one of the things that we do use to predict to give our forecast. So in other words, solar cycles and sunspot activity, that those are things that we take into account when we make our forecast. So I would say, you know, there's that same thread that Robert B. Thomas was using back in the 18th century. We're still using that today and still believe that solar activity does have a bearing on our weather.
Marty, I think that a couple of real attractions to the Old Farmer's Almanac. The reason it's so popular is exactly because you stick your neck out. People are enthralled when people stick their neck out and say, it looks like it's going to be this, and of course, intrigued by that. But also all the fun facts and the fun folkloric things that Kathy alluded to as well that appear in the Old Farmer's Almanac. I wondered, in looking back across your history, how has the popularity increased? You must have certainly started like 200 years ago with just a handful of volumes sold, but today it must be pretty prolific.
It is. It is. You know, we just finished our 216th edition, and we now publish about 4 million copies in the United States, and we also do close to 400,000 in Canada. So we have more and more readers every year. And we also have a website so that people can access the same information that they find in the almanac on their computer. They can personalize their website so they get the same astronomical data and weather forecasts for their particular site, which is very convenient if you want to find, you know, the exact time the sun will rise or set in your town. So, you know, our popularity has just increased over time. And I think it is a tradition. I think people recognize the almanac, the yellow cover, you know, with the red print with the year in the front and the little hole in the upper left-hand corner. And I think it still is popular today, more popular today than it was years ago.
You still keep the little hole in the corner, huh?
We do. We do. We had thought about taking that out, actually, and we polled our readers several years ago, but that, because it cost about close to $50,000 to put that hole in.
What?
Yes, yes.
But that's an expensive hole.
Yes, yes. Our readers unanimously said, no, leave the hole in. So it's in there. It will. I'm sure it will stay forever. And if you do go to our website, in the upper left-hand corner of each web page, there's a little black hole. So it's become a trademark.
I wonder what readers do with the hole then. Do you, I mean, do they really? Never mind.
Yes,
I don't know if it's just part of the deal.
It is.
Okay.
It is.
Marty, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And take care of yourself. That's Marty Majoros. She's the research editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac. Believe it or not, there are a number of cities in Florida without tornado warning sirens. That may seem a little odd, given that, on average, about 50 tornadoes hit Florida each year. And, Paul, you've contacted someone on this?
Yes, Kathy. Tom Sorrells is a meteorologist with WKMG, Local 6 in Orlando, Florida, the CBS affiliate down there. Tom, welcome to Jet Streaming.
Hey, good. How you doing, guys? Everything good in Minnesota?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Have you had snow yet?
Not yet. We're trying to hold it off as long as possible.
I understand. I love that comment you made, Kathy, when you say, believe it or not, there are some towns that don't. More to the point, Kathy, none of them do. There's only one city that does.
Yeah, and we just saw, is it, how do you pronounce it,
Oviedo?
Oviedo, Florida.
Oviedo, Florida.
The
yes,
first city in Florida to install tornado sirens just this month here. Putting in 8 new sirens. And Tom, if you look at the number of tornadoes by state per area in the past 50 years, Florida's number one, even higher than Oklahoma, which is in the heart of Tornado Alley. I guess the obvious question is, what took them so long?
Well, here's the deal, Paul. Normally, you know, that stat you throw out there that says, hey, we're number one in number, normally what we're dealing with are gale-type tornadoes or gust-front tornadoes, or maybe a waterspout tornado that comes ashore. We're talking about what I like to refer to as chihuahua tornadoes, you know, small ones that rip off awnings but don't hurt people. It's only been in the last few years that we've suddenly been able to generate and track big F1, 2, and 3 tornadoes. So they are very prevalent here, not as prevalent as where you are in the Midwest, from Minnesota down to Oklahoma and to Texas and those spots. We normally don't get the big, gigantic ones. So for historical reasons, it's never been thought of as a big issue to people here. The biggest issue here has always been hurricanes for media attraction and lightning, of course, because we are the lightning capital of North America. So more to the point of what has taken them so long, is that it's not a cultural thing. It's not something that they grew up with. The folks who live here grew up fearing tornadoes per se. It's just not something that has ever captured the imagination or the attention of the people around. The thing that I think you would find surprising is that even after the Groundhog Day tornadoes that we had on February 2nd, we had some big ones here. They're on the new enhanced Fujita scale. These were coming in with wind speeds of 160.
Yeah, and I saw a death toll of at least, I think, 19 for that
outbreak. More like 21.
More like 21, and it happened in the morning, 3 a.m., right?
It did hit in the dead of the night. So here's the thing I think you'd find most interesting is that even after that, a lot of the city leaders and even some of the, I'm hesitant to name them, but more of the Weather Service people still were not huge proponents of the sirens. And here's the reasons that they gave. First of all, it's cost prohibitive. Okay. And second of all, the sound from those sirens normally travels anywhere from 2 to 8 miles, and we're talking about a vast region. So even if your city had them, like if Lady Lake had them, this tornado hit in Lady Lake and traveled well on out to the more rural areas where the sound from the sirens probably wouldn't have carried anyway. And the third big thing is everyone here in Florida closes their windows at night. Everyone has air conditioning. And so when you're in the confines of your home, even in the dead of the night, you're really going to have to be close to one of those sirens for the sound to penetrate your home and give you adequate warning. They almost always come back to personal responsibility. And what they really would like for everyone to do is have a weather radio. I was stunned by the stats. I don't know if you guys, being not familiar with who you are in Minnesota, I don't know, A, are you only on radio, or B, are you on TV, or both?
We all have experience in both.
Okay. Well, here in my market, obviously I'm the chief met at the CBS station, but I also do weather radio for our big religious station and our jazz station. And in your mind, when bad weather's happening, you think, wow, they're watching us. We have to be on. We're on the air in wall-to-wall coverage. And my competition, they're on the air. Both other, all three of the big players at ABC and NBC and the Fox, were all on the air at the same time in wall-to-wall coverage. And when those Groundhog Day tornadoes hit, total television viewership was less than 1% in the market. Because you can imagine, who is watching TV at 3 a.m.?
No one, or very few people. Yeah,
very few people. I looked at the numbers, and you know, and when it's over, we all like to go. At that time, we were the market leader with more viewership. At that time of danger, more of them turned to no one because no one was up watching television at that hour.
Say, Tom, Mark Seely here. It begs the question, you know, since the specific area message encoding has been out along with the alarmed NOAA weather radio for quite a few years now. It seems like Florida would have been the ideal test bed for deploying these all over the state, school systems, homes, businesses, etc., so that, you would trigger an alarm, which is quite audible in those kind of environments when there was severe weather. But has that not been the case?
That simply has not been the case. That has not been the case. We've been slow to react and slow to do it. And it's just been, I'm telling you, it's a cultural thing here to where it was never thought of before and never, most people here were never aware of just how many tornadoes we have and certainly never taught to fear the big F3 and big F4s. They just simply don't happen here much. When they do, it is a huge wake-up call. We had a huge one in Kissimmee back in 98, and then the Groundhog Day tornadoes here back in February have suddenly pushed it to the fore. And that's the reason that Oviedo went ahead and spent the city's money, almost $200,000 of their budget, to put in 8 sirens. And that is one small... When we say it's a city, it's a small city here in Florida. It's not Orlando. It isn't Melbourne. It's not Daytona Beach. It's a small community in Oviedo. It's growing, but it's a small community.
What's the reaction so far?
The people of Oviedo seem to really love it. And there are people who are calling for and asking for sirens everywhere. But I hate to be the guy who pushes the button all the time, but every single time it comes up, people always come back with, it's not cost-effective, you won't hear it, and the best thing you can do is protect yourself with a weather radio.
Well, agreed with that for sure, Tom. I guess in this part of the country, we're a little stunned to hear that. We've had civil defense sirens here, I don't know, since the 50s, before I was born, and they've been used for tornadoes for decades here, and it does provide a valuable service, though not perfect, like you say. Here's a thought for you. Here's an idea. We've had several TV stations here, at least a couple of them in our market, this year do successful, wildly successful weather radio drives.
Oh, those are done.
And I mean, over 10,000 radios sold
right,
at one station. And so is that happening down there?
Yes, absolutely. been done by two or three different stations in the market, and will continue for here on after.
Tom, one hole in our regional system and still exists today is, although we do have sirens deployed across the Western Great Lakes region, there are some of them that are not supplied with emergency power backup. So if they come off, if the storm knocks out the electric grid, they're not able to trip these. Are you considering, or I should say the community in Florida, considering backup power systems?
That has not even been broached. No one has said a word about it as far as the support of the sirens in Oviedo. I'm not sure how they have that thing wired. My guess is they have it into the city emergency power, but I don't know for certain. I really don't know. And there are only 8 of those sirens. So while it's a big issue that one city actually did put in sirens, there's only 8 of them in the whole state.
Wow. I'm still trying to get over this.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's something you never would have thought of and never heard of before.
Sounds like an opportunity for state leadership.
More to the point on that, our governor in the past, Jeb Bush, was a guy who got weather. He got it very much. He was a very good leader. Democrats and Republicans alike thought pretty highly of him during our hurricane seasons. He was a good leader, out front, bilingual, getting all over it, making sure we evacuated, getting the National Guard lined up if need be, rushing FEMA around, very pushy. And Charlie Crist has been our new governor since January and was the guy on the clock when the tornadoes tore through in February. He was on site the next day. He was there pretty quickly. But they haven't come up. That's where it just sort of stopped. The ball just sort of went, Haven't seen a lot of action since then as to whether or not they're ever going to come up with a siren system. And I haven't heard him on record say whether he supports such moves or not.
Well, obviously the Oviedo situation, I'm sure state officials will be watching that. So it should be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I'd like to see a public outcry for it. I myself am a proponent for it. I'm a proponent for everything.
Wow. Interesting story, Tom. Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Hey, anytime. And if we do better in the future, if things do start to change, I'd love to come back on and give you the update that, hey, things have gone our way. We have sirens all over Central Florida, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Well, we'll see what happens. Tom, thanks a lot.
Sure, anytime.
That's Tom Sorrells. He's a meteorologist with WKMG-TV in Orlando, Florida. Gentlemen, it is time for the weather website of the week. Dr. Seeley, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kathy. You know, since we talked earlier about the seasonal outlooks, particularly what might be ahead of us this winter, I thought it'd be a good time to refer listeners to a wonderful site operated by the NOAA National Operational Hydrologic Remote Sensing Center, which is a mouthful. It's located here in Minnesota, nohrsc.nws.gov. Or you can just search under any of the operational hydrologic remote sensing terms. It'll probably come up. But if you're a snow lover and you want to keep track of who's getting snow and how much, or you want to assess where you can take your snowmobile or go do a little cross-country skiing or any number of other things, they have wonderful imagery there of not only local scale landscape and differences across, for example, Minnesota, they even scale it up to the northern hemisphere. So you can watch the onset of snow deposition across the northern hemisphere this winter if you want to.
Kathy, no, I'm sure you just love to watch that.
Oh, I'm going to be planted right in front of that computer, just clicking away, seeing the snow as it marches toward us.
She likes it warm, so that'd be tough for her.
Well, we're going to have to go put that particular website on. We'll have to link to that because actually it is kind of interesting. That's a geeky website, Mark Seeley.
It is. It's a niche website, no question about it.
I like that, though. That's all right. Paul Huttner and Mark Seeley, thank you for joining us. That was interesting with Tom Sorrells, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sounds like a hot-button issue down there. I think we're going to hear more about that in the coming years.
I think we will. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Kathy.
We'll talk to you guys later. And thanks to you for being with us for another Jet Streaming podcast. If you like what you hear, tell your friends. If not, keep it to yourself. If you have a question for our experts, send it along by clicking on the Jet Streaming Podcast at minnesotapublicradio.org and filling out the question form. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.